If you ask, as many literary critics do, what good are we from the perspective of those who wish to cure cancer or bring peace to the Middle East, the answer can only be disheartening. But if in response to this demand for justification, we tell ourselves and others the story of our discipline and immerse ourselves as we were immersed in graduate school in the lore and skill of a specialized craft, we may find a satisfaction in that story. When all is said and done, there is no reason for any discipline to exist except for what is brought into the world by the possibility of its practice. What you gain by maintaining an enterprise is the very special and specific pleasures and consolations it affords. Those pleasures and consolations should be thought of neither as the vehicles of our salvation nor as obstacles to our salvation. They are what they are, and so are we.
Literary expert Stanley Fish. He's here to talk about his new book, Professional Correctness, an account of literary studies and political change. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Later on the program this week, you'll also hear from critic David Denby. His new book is entitled Great Books, My Adventures with Homer, Rousseau, Wolfe, and Other Indestructible Writers of the Western World. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products.
The literary critic, as I imagine him or her, is a specialist, defined and limited by the traditions of craft. And it is a condition of his or her labors, at least as they are exerted in the United States, that they remain distanced from any effort to work changes in the structure of society. It is not that society's structure is unalterable, or that there could never come a day when the words of a literary critic will resound in the halls of Congress. It's just that I do not see that day coming soon, and I do not think anything you or I could do will bring it closer. Samuel Goldman once said in response to someone who asked him why his movies were not more concerned with important social issues, "If I wanted to send a message, I'd use Western Union." I say, if you want to send a message that will be heard beyond the Academy, get out of it. Or if I may adapt a patriotic slogan, the Academy, love it or leave it.
Stanley Fish teaches law and literature at Duke University. His new book is Professional Correctness, an account of literary studies and political change. For openers, I asked Stanley Fish to reflect on the evolution of literary studies in our culture over the past 50 years.
Very basically, the change came about, I would say, in the late 50s and early 60s, and is a change not only in literary studies, but across the field in many disciplines. In many disciplines at the same time, people began to take an historical attitude toward the routines of their own professional work. By a historical attitude, I mean they began to see what they did not only as obligatory in the sense that it corresponds to the truth, but they began to see what they did as the product of a historical emergence of which they were the culmination, but not the end.
Does that mean that literature generated this this uneasy relationship with the larger world, or the larger world imposed it on the academics?
Well, I think that what happened was, for reasons that I've never been able to determine, a certain self-consciousness about what academics did in many disciplines began to be part of their subject, so that academics began not only to do things, do history, literary criticism, anthropology, history of science, but to inquire into the conditions of possibility, as they came to say, which made it possible for them to do them. This then historicized their efforts in the sense that they could no longer, at least when they were doing this kind of analysis, see their efforts as natural or inevitable. They began to see the social, political structures within which what they did made sense, as opposed to assuming that what they did made sense because it corresponded with the unadorned facts of the world.
Let's go back, Stanley Fish. We're talking about your book, Professional Correctness, Literary Studies and Political Change. Let's go back several hundred years to the figure of Sir Philip Sidney. Mm-hmm. This is the guy who told us, after a fashion, that we can both learn from and enjoy literature. The implicit in his work, in this defense of poetry that he wrote, is the idea that literature should be engaged with what, in your book, you call the larger structures of the world. You want to go after Sir Philip?
Not at all. In fact, I think that Sir Philip Sidney's wonderful work, in fact, supports my position. One of the great sentences from that work, one that I always offer to my students, especially when we're studying Renaissance humanism, goes something as follows. I won't remember it exactly. He's talking about the moment in Virgil's Aeneid when the hero Aeneas picks up his father Anchises and carries him across a large part of the terrain. And Sidney says, who does not, when reading of Aeneas carrying old Anchises on his back, wish that he were such a person, mm-hmm. and resolve to imitate him? Now, in that sense, what Sidney is saying is that when you read literary works which present models of virtuous behavior, you respond to them in such a way that your own behavior will, in particular situations, be materially altered for the better. Mm-hmm. This is a very old and honorable view of the possible effects of literary study and engagement on the moral life. And it's a view still argued today by very intelligent and informed critics and philosophers like Wayne Booth and Martha Nussbaum, mm-hmm. In recent books. But notice what it is not. It is not a call for you to directly go out and vote for someone or join a picket line or attempt in some way to alter the political structure of your county.
In other words, this is why you say that you don't want your work here in Professional Correctness, Stanley, to be misconstrued as support for the neoconservative cultural and political, the right wing there.
I don't want what I'm saying to be support for any particular political agenda, mm-hmm. either a left-wing or progressive one on the one hand, or a conservative or a neoconservative one mm-hmm. on the other. Both sides in the culture war are claiming that if their view of what it means to study literature is accepted, certain political consequences will follow. What I want to say is that political consequences never follow from different ways of doing literary study. Mm-hmm. What follows, and what I think should follow, are changes in the ways that literary study is done. What follows are changes in the professional structure. Now, of course, someone will immediately respond, but people who study different texts in different ways will, when they enter the world, act differently. And my answer to that is yes and no. That is, they might, but you as an instructor cannot be assured when you set out to teach your work in a certain way that it will fall on the ears of your students in a particular way. Mm-hmm. We have all had the experience of someone coming back to us after 15 or 20 years and saying, oh, professor, I remember that day when you said X about work Y, and I understood it as meaning Z, and I have ordered my life in that fashion.
And you
think to yourself, I would have never said X about Y. And the fact that he or she has concluded Z and ordered a life in that fashion absolutely horrifies me. Who am I to give life advice or large political advice to students? That's not my job. I wasn't elected or appointed to do that. And so I have a very strong sense, and I believe that peoples in general should have a very strong sense of obligation to the job that they have been hired to perform.
Well, now, wait. There are people listening to this conversation, Stanley Fish, who say that you have been, after a fashion, charged with helping to shape the moral lives, the moral characters of these young people who come and sit in your classrooms at Duke University. Now, you're not a preacher. You're not the father of these kids. But you do have an enormous influence on them. You're backing away from that influence.
Well, I think that I would hope that the influence I have is mitigated by the influence of the person's class into which they move after they leave mine.
Mm-hmm.
My view of teaching in the classroom is that you teach your position, your take, as it were,
but it's not the last
on
word.
The various texts uh-huh. and bodies of work, and you do it with intensity and with conviction and with passion. And what you count on is your colleagues doing the same thing uh-huh. in some other directions. And then the students move from you to the others, and what they take away is their own configuration.
So the students are complaining, and they're actually being a little lazy if they say, well, I'm not getting, or the parents are saying, are being lazy if they accuse Stanley Fish of not helping to shape their kids morally and in terms of character. It is not, it's a continuity of experiences. It's not one single sort of instance.
Well, going back to an earlier question, those who are on the neoconservative right believe that it is the job of teachers of literature to shape students morally according to a certain set of dictates which they will pronounce and announce at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. Those on the left have their own set of dictates, usually marked by words and phrases like critical self-consciousness, an awareness of the precariousness of our present cultural norms, etc. Again, the demand is that we teach students a way of thinking which will be subversive of the very things that the right-wingers wish to preserve. I teach Milton. Uh-huh. I teach the First Amendment.
Uh-huh.
I teach relationships between church and state. Those are my subjects. Those are my materials. I know what I'm talking about, or at least I hope I do, when I teach in those areas. And I don't think that, and I do believe that there is certainly going to be an effect of a moral kind on some of the students to whom I teach these materials. But that, again, cannot be what I aim for. What I aim for is professional skill and competence.
Well, Stanley, it is always an immense pleasure to talk to you about your work. We've been speaking of professional correctness. The subtitle is Literary Studies and Political Change. This book resulted from the Clarendon Lectures at Oxford University in 1993. You are a professor of literature and law at Duke University, a good friend of the National Humanities Center. Stanley, it's always fun to talk with you. I certainly wish you well in the work that you do,
which includes being executive director of the Duke University Press. As a professional, I must give a plug.
You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, more about literature and American education. I'll talk next with critic David Denby. His new book is entitled Great Books: My Adventures with Homer, Rousseau, Wolfe, and Other Indestructible Writers of the Western World.
The initial impulse was to jump into the cultural wars from the ground up.
Uh-huh.
But there's something else was that I was tired of living in the media solely, and I think we all live in the media in some ways, some of us more than others. I'm immersed in it because I'm a journalist, film critic, and I you know, what Guy Debord called the society of the spectacle was beginning to oppress me somewhat, and I couldn't see where all of this imagery floating around and representation ended, and I began. I felt I actually lost myself, middle-aged blahs, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
identity crisis. I hate these cliches. But I suppose there is a therapeutic side to this.
David Denby is the film critic for New York Magazine. But his new book takes him away from the movies and into the classroom. He says that a few years ago, in the midst of grousing about the culture wars in American education, his wife told him to put his complaints on the line. So Denby went back to Columbia University to retake the Great Books courses that he'd been through 30 years earlier. The result is Great Books, My Adventures with Homer, Rousseau, Wolfe, and Other Indestructible Writers of the Western World.
Well, I think there's always a sort of apples and oranges problem here when journalists write about the universities, because journalists and critics, like myself, are by nature empirical and pragmatic. We're interested in the shape of a work of art or entertainment, what it looks like, what it tastes like, and then we work from the outside, and then we move in to see if there's any inner life there. And we don't have much interest in how we know things, epistemologies, or what the cultural and economic background, the means of production, let's call it, of a work of art are. That's very, very secondary for us. So there is a kind of mismatch, but I thought this stuff should be accessible to anyone who's curious and intelligent, and I should be able to know, go in and using what I know about pleasure, which is absolutely essential to movie criticism, try to connect the pleasures, the rather shallow and immediate pleasures of movie going, to the deeper pleasures of literature.
Well, not to mention the fact that you are dealing as a student and working with students, you're dealing with kids who come out of this media world. They're not prepared for the ground rules of high literary arcane theory.
No, nor are they interested in it, nor should they be subjected to it as freshmen. I mean, if anything, that can come much later when they're graduate students. Perhaps a lot of the culture wars debate and the ideological discussions of literature are of no interest to 18 or 19-year-olds. They do come out of a media background. They haven't read much. The high schools are not preparing them well, often not even asking them to read much literature. But if they get to these good universities, they are hungry. They are hungry for the big books and the big ideas, and they know there's something tremendous out there, and they know nothing of it. So they can be taught, and often, I mean, I record a lot of this in the book, their initial responses are naive, and a good teacher will take those responses and try to work them back against the students, to provoke them, tease them, embarrass them, and then we get to something real after a while.
Well, let's talk concretely and specifically,
sure.
David Denby. Again, Lit Hum, Literature, Humanities, and CC, Contemporary Civilization, the objects of your book, Great Books. Let me pitch you an example here. We move from Homer to Virginia Woolf. What does an undergraduate kid make out of the Iliad or the Odyssey? What is he or she being asked to make of it
for
them?
They read these gigantic poems right at the beginning of their freshman year in college. They have never read anything like a 15,693-line poem before, most of them. And they are, the Iliad is very difficult. It's not, we're talking about the Richmond Lattimore translation, not difficult to understand from line to line, of course.
But very different compared to what they're used to.
Very far away from their lives, their experience, and the length of it is daunting, and the number of battles. And of course, this stuff, you know, was chanted, and there is a lot of repetition, although each block is subtly different from the previous block. But I think some of them find it oppressive at first, but then if they work with a teacher, and I record the way Professor Taylor gives them a handle on the structure of the poem, so they begin to see how these enormous pieces fit together and reflect on one another. They learn how to read it. Well, then the teachers will analyze specific passages, try to relate that to the entire work.
Well, now, one of the things that stayed with me in your book, Great Books, David Denby, is that the professors here are teaching these Great Books courses are asking these kids to assume sort of vicariously other selves. I mean, of course, they're being asked to look at these large structural issues that you've been describing.
Right.
But one of the purposes is to get the kid out of the kid's skin, so to speak. Tell us about that.
Well, they need to, they're all narcissistic when they come in, as we all are. And one of the purposes of higher education, I think, is to break down that kind of trivial narcissism. So what I love about these courses is because the books are now so far away from the students, it forces them to confront the other. There's a kind of joke here because the academic left has been saying we should stop reading, the works of dead white males, and we should be reading works composed by African Americans. And of course, we should, but perhaps not in a course like this, where it turns out that the classics of the Western tradition are the other. for undergraduates, and they're just as far away from white males as they are from African American males, just as far away from men as they are from women. So when they get to Dido's death in the Aeneas, in the Aeneid, the women were appalled that anyone would kill herself over love. There was a kind of higher dedication to principle and honor that is very, very far from the sort of therapeutic and weakly, I don't want to say amoral, but unprincipled nature of modern contemporary consumer society. I mean, they are confronting the other in reading these works that are allegedly their birthright.
Mm-hmm. David, I want you to be anecdotal for me. Your book is Great Books, My Adventures with Homer, Rousseau, Wolfe, et cetera, in the Western world. Tell us about some of your favorite experiences, moments of clarity for you when you were grappling with these issues.
Well, I had a lot of trouble concentrating at first because here I am, my concentration has fragmented. So hauling my concentration together, pulling it together, was a major struggle. And the great victory for me was the most difficult text, which was Hegel's Introduction to the Philosophy of History. Now, this is known as easy Hegel, easy for whom, I was saying to myself, and I felt angry and lost, and I was making, you know, satirical and sarcastic remarks about Hegel for about a week. But I read it over and over again and began to understand how his language worked, and that was a great moment for me.
Well, now let me present you with an enormous challenge, and I don't mean to be sarcastic or flip. What does Hegel have to say to students in the 1990s? I mean, is there a way, on the one hand, we don't want to defeat the purpose of this book by arriving at a convenient little boxed maxims. On the other hand, what do you say to people who are listening to this conversation about why a dead white male is important to these kids here in the middle of the decade?
Well, it's 100 pages of Hegel, no more. But the value of it, I think, is to introduce them to a very different way of thinking, namely dialectical thinking, than they're used to. And the reaction of forces upon themselves and the growing of new forces out of opposites and so on, everything that's there. And it's not that Hegel invented dialectics, of course, but the way he formulated it, and the fascination of following it through the changing historical epochs, because the introduction sort of lays out the ground plan.
Well, what you're doing
is
you're giving them a new vocabulary. You're giving them a way to talk about things that presumably they know, or at least will be amenable to knowing. Are we on the right track there?
Forcing them to think in a different way, to formulate action and response and the movement of forces in a different way that is, you know, German metaphysics couldn't be further from American speech, even if it came from another planet.
Right.
So
it does.
It does come from another planet. You know how you have to read Hegel? You have to read him aloud. After all, this stuff was not meant to be read. It was lecture notes,
this
most of it.
This is tough stuff, right.
It was assembled, most of his texts were assembled after he died by students and colleagues. So if I could, you know, take people by the hand and lead them into the labyrinth of one of these texts by showing how teachers and students are led into the labyrinth of one of these texts, I thought that might be of some value in breaking down this awful distance. And people speak of the classics as if it had nothing to do whatever with their lives and was some, you know, awesome thing. This stuff was not written to be studied in courses. It was written for pleasure and for instruction, and it was read not in courses probably until in the last century. I mean, obviously the universities and earlier versions of the universities kept these books alive, but people read them on their deathbed. They read them in the backyard. They read them on ocean voyages.
Right.
They struggled with them. They read them out of context, higgledy-piggledy order, without, you know, without an academic background, without a syllabus.
Right.
We are dealing here with an artificial construction as if it were literature.
Now, let me challenge you for a moment, David.
Sure.
You talk about the difference or the continuities between art and entertainment. After all, you make your living as a film critic for New York Magazine. Are you one of the bad guys, actually, who's creating the atmosphere into which we put these kids and then say to them, come away with a sense of Western civilization when they live in a world that's driven by goodness knows how bad it's all going to get. I mean, when you look at the TV shows and the movies and where all that's headed.
Well, you're right. And I mean, the only thing I can say is that I'm trying to induce discrimination. in the discussion of popular culture. Any good critic will do that. And I don't know exactly what I've taken out of my education that I'm using in my movie reviewing. I think it would be hard to pin down. Uh-huh. But it's there in taste, judgment, sensibility. I am trying to separate the bad from the good and celebrate the good as much as I can. That's what the best of us are doing. Unfortunately, film criticism has fallen onto sorry days, and most of it is now just part of the marketing operation for movies. So I think criticism is actually more necessary than ever. That is, someone has to stand between the publicity department of the major studios and the audience. So I'm very excited this week because I just saw a film by Mike Lee, which is called Secrets and Lies, which is opening the New York Film Festival, and I think it's a real work of art. And this happens about once every 2 years,
right,
at this point. But you know, I can light up the sky with it for a week, and then go back to Sylvester Stallone the following week and try not to make a bunch of sour jokes. The real problem is falling to the level of what the bad stuff you're writing about, and just becoming a sour-stomached, repetitive, sarcastic person.
Mm-hmm. David Denby is the film critic for New York Magazine. His new book is entitled Great Books, My Adventures with Homer, Rousseau, Wolfe, and Other Indestructible Writers of the Western World, available from Simon & Schuster. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were Stanley Fish of Duke University and David Denby of New York Magazine. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 852. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week on Soundings, the first of two programs for Black History Month 1997. You'll hear discussions about African-American culture, featuring scholars from Princeton University, North Carolina Central University, Williams College, and Harvard University. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.